Well, it's hard to imagine that anyone would be a sex worker voluntarily or actually like that life. Yet when author and journalist Allison Bass set out to learn more about the trade, she was surprised to find out that prostitutes who see positive aspects to their profession are more common than you might think. 4 years of interviews and research later, Bass has a book out on the topic, Getting Screwed, Sex Workers and the Law, in which she presents arguments for decriminalizing prostitution. A longtime medical and science writer for the Boston Globe, Allison Bass now teaches journalism at West Virginia University, and she joins us now from Morgantown, West Virginia. Allison, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good to be with you.
Well, one of the first things the book presents is that not all sex workers are drug addicts, you know, poor, walking the streets. What's a more likely background story for a prostitute?
In fact, most sex workers are in the profession by choice. There was a recent study done by the Urban Justice Institute in New York that surveyed a lot of sex workers there and that found that only 16% have been coerced into the trade. So the majority are doing it by choice. A lot of them are middle class and working class women who are paying down student loans, paying their way through college, using sex work to raise families as single mothers because it gives them a great deal of flexibility. Even someone like Jillian, who is a young activist in Northampton, Massachusetts, who really styles herself as a latter-day Emma Goldman and wants to change the world and does a lot of volunteering on behalf of disenfranchised people like the homeless. She does sex work 10 hours a week so she can spend most of her time volunteering and trying to help people who need help.
But still, for some, it's a matter of little else being open to them, right, and needing a means of support.
Yes, there's no question that many sex workers are in it for economic reasons, but it is still a choice. They would rather do sex work than work in a lowly paid job in Walmart, and many of them are college graduates. In addition, a good number of them enjoy the work. They feel like they're doing a service. They're providing a service to men, some cases who can't get the kind of companionship and sexual intimacy they would like. A lot of them feel empowered by doing sex work.
You know, how did the internet change the game here? Because what did it provide for those in the trade that they didn't have before? And I'm guessing it was a lot.
Well, absolutely. It actually makes them more independent and less likely to rely on pimps to find clients for them. So it's actually been very empowering and helpful and has helped make working conditions safer for many sex workers, so they can advertise themselves and screen clients themselves. And in addition, internet websites that provide ads like Craigslist and Backpage, they work with law enforcement to target those few people who may be trafficking in underage prostitutes and go after them. But the most of the women and men who are advertising on these sites, again, are doing sex work by choice, and allows them to screen clients in a safe manner and arrange liaisons.
And then I guess the flip side of the coin, how much easier did going digital make it for law enforcement, Allison, to track and arrest the workers themselves?
Well, actually, sex workers who really know their business, they're very careful to find out who is their client, where they work, and they get their real names and phone numbers. So they're very, they're able to screen out undercover cops who are wasting our taxpayers' dollars by going after sex workers who are in the profession by choice. At the same time, these websites are working with law enforcement to, like I said, target traffickers who may try to put up ads for underage prostitutes.
Do you find that some police departments have backed off given the fact there is a consensual arrangement going on here and that this isn't the highest priority for them?
Well, there was an interesting study that was done a number of years ago that found that the 16 largest cities spent more on Vice Squad to entrap and arrest sex workers, most of whom were doing it by choice, than they did on healthcare or education for their citizens. However, many metropolitan police forces today tend to target minority sex workers who are most of those out on the street and sex workers at the lower end of the scale. And yes, they leave the higher end escorts who are working with top government officials alone. So the people, the sex workers who are being harassed by police and arrested are often those at the lower end of the scale, and many of them are minorities.
We're talking about legalizing prostitution with Allison Bass, a journalist. Her new book, Getting Screwed, Sex Workers and the Law. You know, there are types of workers based on where you ply the trade. You know, there's indoor workers, brothels, streetwalkers. Who has it the toughest, Allison, in terms of why they're where they're at and in terms of working conditions?
Well, first of all, according to a recent study, only about 2% of all sex workers are streetwalkers. So most of them are indoors plying their trade. So that's a big misconception among the public. But clearly, streetwalkers do have the toughest conditions because they're, you know, on the street, and some of them are drug addicted and working to pay for their next fix. So what they need are social services. What they don't need to do is be arrested and traumatized by the criminal justice system. What they need are rehab services to help them overcome their addiction so they don't have to be walking the streets. But it's those vulnerable and marginalized women who are walking the streets who are most at risk of being hurt by violent clients and harassed by police. And that's why I think we need to decriminalize sex work for everyone.
You know, it seems to me that, you know, Western culture over the years has heavily stigmatized sex work. How does the profession manage to overcome this, or can it?
Well, this stigmatization is centuries old, and it comes about. I read this fascinating study by a Yale professor who wrote about the sociology of prostitution. And there are two institutions that are very similar. One is marriage and one is sex work. They both offer sex in exchange for other things. Marriage, it's more implicit. Sex work is more explicit. So the churches and governments needed to separate these two institutions, because after all, marriage is where you get children and reproduction, while as in sex work, it's pure sex is purely for recreation. So they basically put marriage on a pedestal and they vilified sex work. And that's been going on for centuries. And then you layer onto it the attitudes that women should not be enjoying sex, particularly with multiple partners. And that makes it even worse. And that's where the moralistic viewpoint about sex work comes from.
Well, I want to bring in Taina Ben-Ami, executive director of the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women. She joins us from her office in New York City. And Taina, good morning. Nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, your organization has opposed the recent push from Amnesty to decriminalize all aspects of the sex trade. Why?
Well, the Amnesty decision, which is not 100% finalized because it still has to be reviewed by its international board, but in Dublin in August of this year, the delegates voted. It was a very, very contentious debate, but ultimately they voted for full decriminalization of the sex trade. And the decision is in two parts. So the first part is recognizing the violence, the marginalization, the stigmatization, the abuse inflicted by police and others of prostituted individuals. We don't use the term sex work, all of which we agree. But the second part to that decision is Amnesty's contention that in order to protect those vulnerable, marginalized, brutalized people, we need to also decriminalize their exploiters, including pimps, brothel owners, and buyers of sex, or johns, which really makes absolutely no sense. You don't need to be enmeshed in this field to recognize that if you do want to protect the exploited, then the last thing governments need to do is to decriminalize or legitimize the source of the exploitation and violence.
You know, Allison, what results, what have we learned from countries where prostitution is legal?
Well, basically, in countries like New Zealand and the Netherlands and other European countries where it has been decriminalized and regulated to some extent, it is much safer working conditions. It also reduces the rate of HIV, and I'll explain why. When sex workers can negotiate, have the time to negotiate safe sex, i.e. sex with condoms, they're obviously less at risk of sexually transmitted diseases as well as their clients. And in countries like New Zealand and the Netherlands, the rate of HIV is among the lowest in the world. In addition, when sex work is decriminalized, sex workers can work with police to target violent predators and exploitative pimps. Sex workers are like canaries in the coal mine. They are the first to see violent predators and serial killers at work. And in countries where it's illegal, like the United States, because they fear being arrested themselves, they don't report these violent predators to the police. So you take serial killers like Gary Ridgway, the infamous Green River killer in Washington, or Ted Bundy. Sex workers were among the first to know that Gary Ridgway was the Green River killer, but they were afraid to report that to the police. And the one or two sex workers who were brave enough to go to the police were ignored and dismissed. And Gary Ridgway went on to murder upwards of 49 women, not all of them prostitutes. So basically, criminal laws against prostitution encourage violence against all women.
Taina, in some other countries where sex work is legal, I'm thinking about Sweden, where they have something called the Nordic model. What does that mean and how does it work?
Well, first, I'd like to say that Allison and I are reading radically different studies. Our work is really informed on the experiences and leadership of survivors of the sex trade. We work with direct service providers. Our work is informed by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Global Grassroots Women's Rights Movement, and international law, all of which Amnesty is seemingly ignoring. So, what the Swedish model has done, and basically for the listener, because it is very confusing to think about the different legal frameworks, there are three major legal frameworks: full criminalization, which is the United States, except for a few counties in Nevada, where you can't buy, you can't sell sex. I agree with Allison, there is a discriminate impact on women by the laws. We believe that the prostituted individuals, who are mostly women and girls, must not be criminalized. And then there is full decriminalization or legalization or deregulation, however you want to call it, like the Netherlands, Germany, New Zealand, where brothels or businesses like any other businesses, where because women have choices in those countries to pursue schools or go into the workforce, the demand, which is now greenlit by the government, needs to be met. And how do the pimps and traffickers meet that need? Is by trafficking women. So you see in brothels in the Netherlands, in Germany, which is catastrophic, brothels with up to 80-90% of women from the poorest countries of Eastern Europe and from the global south. New Zealand is being paraded as the quote-unquote model, but I mean, in all fairness, it's a very isolated island. There are more sheep than people. And what they have seen in New Zealand, and the evidence is coming out stronger every day, is that you are seeing an increase of domestic trafficking. So a lot of sex trafficked girls, mostly of disenfranchised communities, Maori, Polynesian. New Zealand does not have a trafficking law that does not require movement, so they're not even focusing on the issue of trafficking. Allison mentioned the term underage prostitute. That is not a term that exists. Any person under the age of 18 who is in the sex trade is, by legal definition, a sex trafficked individual.
Well, Taina, tell me
about these are the elements we need to talk about.
Tell me about the Nordic model in Sweden.
So in 1999, Sweden recognized that in a world where equality between men and women existed, there would be no prostitution. And they also recognized that most of the people in prostitution were people who had been incested as children, homeless, coming from disenfranchised communities, racial and economic inequalities, and therefore they should be protected, they should be given services and provided exit strategies should they wish to leave the sex trade. But on the other hand, in order to tackle this multi-billion dollar industry, it was not acceptable for men to purchase women for sex or to purchase any individuals for sex. So what the Nordic model, or what Gloria calls it, the third way, is really, it's an equality model that that only punishes those who purchase sex. And obviously third-party exploiters like Tims and brothel owning is, is not legal as it is in the Netherlands and Germany. But the interesting thing about the Nordic model, which is now being adopted by an increasing number of governments, especially we've seen this in the last 2 years, is that there's also a change of culture. So before the Swedish law, 72% of men believed that it was acceptable to purchase women for sex. Now, 16 years after the law, 76% of men believe that it's an impediment to gender equality and that they would rather be arrested for drunk driving rather than for purchasing a woman for sex. So you also see this radical change of attitudes toward seeing women as full human beings and as equal.
Let me go, Allison, let me go back to this country, Nevada, where one state where it is legal in this country. It's a pretty convoluted system. Explain how it works there.
Well, first of all, I just wanted to mention that in Sweden, first of all, there's been no decrease in sex trafficking in Sweden. And what the Nordic model has done is actually made it more dangerous for working conditions for sex workers. They are much less likely to be able to negotiate safe sex because they are rushed and the clients are afraid of getting arrested themselves. So it actually is a very counterproductive, ineffective model, which is hurting sex workers. Also in New Zealand, when they decriminalized, there has not been an increase in trafficking there, and there has not been an increase in sex workers. So decriminalization does not lead to increases in either sex trafficking or the number of men and women engaged in trafficking. Now, in Nevada, sex work is only legal in rural counties with populations of less than 400,000. And that's because brothels have always been tolerated in Nevada, starting with the days of the old American West. And so brothels never disappeared from brothel and from Nevada and other states in the West, and they just merely legalized those brothels. But in the large cities like Las Vegas and Reno, it is illegal. So what happens is that even though the police turn the other way while elegantly dressed white women pick up gamblers in the casinos for sex work, the police tend to target, again, the streetwalkers and minority streetwalkers. When I was in Nevada, in fact, two African-American women who were there on vacation, okay, both professionals, were actually stopped by the police after coming out of a nightclub and arrested for prostitution. The charges were eventually dropped. But this is the kind of harassment of minorities that goes on with these laws.
Allison, I was going to ask you about Rhode Island. I wasn't aware this was the only other state where it's legal to exchange sex for money. What's Rhode Island doing? What's the model there?
Well, for 30 years, because of a loophole in the law, indoor sex work was permissible. Outdoors sex work was not. In other words, street walking was not. So during this period, incidents of rape and sexually transmitted diseases actually declined in Rhode Island. And that, you know, is one of many studies that show that decriminalizing sex work actually reduces the rate of sexually transmitted diseases and violence against all women. And this is something we really need to consider in this country.
Tyena, I just have a few seconds left. I mean, some feminists struggle with this issue. Let's get down to this question. There are those who say, you know, all sex work is exploitation and the subjugation of women, and those who say a woman has the right to do with what she wants with her body. Where do you come down on this?
Well, then they're not exclusive. Are there a handful of women who, quote unquote, choose this occupation? Absolutely. And at no point are we saying that women can't sell their bodies. However, you know, I like to quote this Native Canadian survivor, Bridget Perrier, who says, she says two things. One is, why is the 2% speaking for the 98%? And second, it's not the laws that are killing women, it is the men. And so to just look at an individual in a vacuum, and you have to be very very careful when we talk about choice and consent, because these are terms that have been used against the movements to end sexual violence, to end domestic violence. It was her choice. It was her agency.
And Taina, I've got to wrap up here, so just if you could.
So we need to look at the whole framework of violence and discrimination against women, and that prostitution is just an extension of that violence.
Taina Bayami is executive director of the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women. Allison Bass is the author of Getting Screwed, Sex Workers and the Law. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
It was good to be with you. Thank you.